Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
All right, it has been obviously a news-filled couple of days here with the remarkable events that have occurred in Iraq with the assassination of that top Iranian general. Joining us right now is somebody who I've talked to before, really who is an extraordinary expert on the Middle East, on Iraq, on Iran. It is a complex web that exists there, and it has become more complicated, I think, in the last 48 hours. I think it's fair to say. Tom Gutierrez is the former Dean of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Nebraska. Tom, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, nice to be with you again, Esme. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, let me ask you, first of all, from where you sit, and this is what your life's work has been, studying this area. Were you shocked by the American action that took out that high-ranking general?
I was. I was shocked, I guess, by the proportion in the manner in which we were kind of going tit for tat with Iran, as we have been doing now ever since we left the Iran nuclear deal. So our relationship with that country has been on a steady decline, and these kind of reciprocals, the cycle of reciprocating activities, revenge activities, has been putting us on this kind of path. But this one is certainly a major type of reaction. And I don't know if it's proportional to the kinds of things that we have seen in the exchanges leading up to it.
Right. There are reports from Iran that the assassinations by the U.S. military of General Soleimani and the others that were with him has served to unite factions in Iran and coalesce them in support of the government there. Is that something that you think probably is happening? And what kind of a sign is that?
Well, I think that is definitely what's happening. If people have been following the news over the last several months, there have been many demonstrations in Iran against the government over matters having to do with gasoline prices and other elements that are more a reflection, I think, of the majority of the population just tiring of a government which is so oppressive, even though there's many civil society activities within Iran in terms of elections and the way the country is constructed and its administration. People are tiring of the theocratic nature of the state. So now what's happened, of course, is those moderate forces, those forces that have been seeking change in their own country, are driven to the more hardcore extremist elements supporting the Ayatollahs and the security forces, which have been used in the past to kind of keep them in place. So this is, in terms of long-term perspective and long-term American interest in that part of the world, this is a setback because people in Iran, like people in most countries, want to experience life like we all do. And they were demonstrating for change to be able to do that.
Well, no one is shedding tears, it sounds like, at least in the Western world, over General Soleimani. I mean, he was, you know, even those who are opposed to what the president did, this was not a good guy. This is somebody who had put together sort of a web, as I understand it, of, you know, groups and terror organizations and connections and sort of stretched throughout, sort of almost like a shadow you know, connections all over the Middle East to terror organizations. Yet,
well, you're correct there, and I think Qasem Soleimani is, you know, seen by almost no one except in Iran or in those circles that depend upon him for support, guidance, etc., in any favorable way. So it's not considered a loss by most. But within, this is an individual who is a member of a state. So it's different when you're engaged against a movement like ISIS, which
right.
is a non-state movement. This is a this is engaging someone who was part of a state. So now it's state against state, our state against their state, the United States against Iran. And so regardless of how we feel about Qasem Soleimani, the fact of the matter is now we are traveling down this kind of cycle of retribution. And if it continues, tit for tat, it's going to lead to greater violence. And I think that's the biggest concern. You almost see a kind of a different pathway towards a similar result like we saw in 2003 with George W. Bush's attack in Iraq and what proceeded from that. It cannot, I think, bode well for our long-term interests. Our long-term interests are better served by peace and the ability to move around in that part of the world where we have many interests relating to transportation, movement of goods, our allies, Israel, etc. And so these kinds of activities tend to destabilize a very volatile region.
Well, in terms of, you know, there are people who are listening to us right now who have loved ones who are serving overseas in that region. There are people who are listening who have loved ones that are going to be serving overseas in that region. Obviously, more troops are being sent there. You know, Americans are being asked to leave Iraq. How wary should we be of retaliation, which has been promised by the Iranian regime? How certain are you that there will be some sort of major retaliation?
Well, of course, no one can be very certain, but the president and his administration is cautioning all of us that there is likely to be something of that nature. The thing to remember, Esme, yes, we have these military personnel serving in various parts around there. We have even more Americans who are working in various parts around, you know, the Middle East as private citizens. They, too, now are going to be, I think, very much in jeopardy, their security. So we have a combination of American citizens, both military, security, and private and public, you know, we are diplomats and things of this nature, who are certainly in this environment of retribution and passion are put in jeopardy. So I think we have to assume that we need to be wary of this environment we're in now.
Is it possible that this this mission that took out not just General Soleimani but other top Iranian leaders, and then there's apparently another airstrike that happened within the past 48 hours as well that has taken some others out. Is it possible that by taking out, and I assume that the Trump administration is banking on this, by taking out those top leaders, it lessens the chances of Iran being capable of mounting some kind of reprisal? By all accounts, this General Soleimani was somewhat of a mastermind in terms of both his ability to connect various organizations together and in terms of military strategy.
Well, when you take out somebody like this, it of course, at least it forces a change perhaps in assessment and in direction if you're leading or the successor leading whatever it was that he leaves behind. And also remember that one of those individuals that was traveling with him, a man by the name of Mukaddes, was from Iraq. So the Iraqis, if you see, are demonstrating in the streets too. We're being asked by the Iraqi citizens to leave. And this is, you know, the country where we spent so much time since 2003.
And do you think that will happen?
Well, I think we're certainly at a juncture where we're close to a precipice, you know, and it could go either way. And it's going to take a lot of able diplomatic effort to prevent us from being forced backward in this situation. And we don't have an administration right now which has demonstrated its capacity or talents in dialogue and negotiations. And so I'm apprehensive because knowing that part of the world as I do, and I'm not trying to state that I'm all knowing, but
well, you are certainly an expert in this part of the world.
Well, thank you for that. But I mean, just knowing this, you got to remember that the Iranians are Shia, and they're 15% of the Muslim world. They feel very, very defensive in the competition that the Sunni Muslims, led by the Saudis, are directing towards them at all times. So everything that happens in the Middle East has this foundation of struggle between Shia and Sunni Muslims, much like the Middle Ages, the Hundred Years' War, the Thirty Years' Wars, et cetera, were struggles between Protestants and Catholics. And so this is very, very serious to them. And so all of these actions in which Soleimani was engaged, he was engaged as part of a national policy, very, very deeply planned policy from Iran with its allies in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, wherever they are, in defending what they thought, defending the status of Shia Muslims in the Middle East vis-a-vis the Sunnis. And you've got to remember that ISIS, in its very beginning, was receiving much of the money that it utilized to grow, not yet from the oil that they later captured, but from monies that were coming out of Sunni coffers in the Persian Gulf, etc. So if you're an Iranian and you see what's going on, you see it through a certain prism. If you're a Saudi or a Sunni, you see it through a certain prism. And this is what we, you know, when we use and we throw around the terms like this guy's a terrorist, this guy's a this, etc., we've got to understand the environment in which they are functioning and why they are taking certain actions that are predicated upon what they believe are their interests. And we need to, you know, seek to avoid complicating our interests and making them more vulnerable by not understanding what the environment really is about.
Well, at this point, it seems like understanding is not someplace that either side seems headed towards. Unfortunately, I think
no, we've come to a point again, you know, to the edge of the cliff or the precipice or whatever it is, where it could go either way. And I hope, of course, that somehow or other we're all able to step back from this. But, you know, the retributions which are coming haven't been begun yet. And when they do take place, then what do we do? How are we going to act? And then how will they act? And then how will we act? We're in this cycle again.
Right.
And that takes us to danger. And again, the most important tool that nations have to avoid these kinds of things are dialogue, diplomacy. And we're not very adroit at the moment in engaging in these things and understanding the environment in which we need to advance our own interests. And if we don't understand that well, we're going to step into the swamps that lie in front of us that pull us in a very, very undesirable fashion.
Well, Tom Gutierrez, thank you so much for your time this evening. Obviously, we're going to continue to monitor this developing situation in the Middle East, in Iran, in Iraq. I appreciate your time and your insights, as always.
Good to get back together with you, Esme. Take care.
Absolutely. You too. Take care. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Coming up in just a few minutes on News Talk 830, we're going to talk with Hardin Lang. He's the Vice President for Programs and Policy of Refugees International, to talk about the impact of this crisis on refugees. But let's take a quick break. You are listening to News Talk 830. It is Esme Murphy, along with the studio producer Jonathan Lowe. We are talking about what is going on in the Middle East and the impact in terms of refugees. Joining us right now is Hardin Lang. He is the Vice President for Programs and Policy of Refugees International. Hardin, thank you so much for joining us. What are your thoughts about these latest developments in the Middle East?
Great. Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think it's hard to look at the events of the last couple of days and not expect some sort of additional escalation to be headed our way in the Middle East. The most immediate thing that comes to mind, you know, there are a couple different options that Iran has to respond to the killing of Qasem.
And do you agree with our previous guest who said expect a response?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think it would be very difficult for the Iranian regime at this stage not to respond in some form. From their perspective, the assassination of such a senior leader inside of their military chain of command requires some sort of response, or else they're gonna fear that they're gonna be looking weak, right, both to their population and externally. And so there are a couple things that they options they have at their disposal. And one, obviously, which I think you guys talked about a little bit before, will be targeting of U.S. forces that are in the region. You know, there's 6,000 U.S. troops in Iraq still, and many of them are garrisoned on bases, much like the ones that were hit last week by mortar fire, in which one American contractor was killed. And so they provide a very vulnerable target in a number of places, as does the U.S. Embassy, as we've seen in Baghdad in recent days.
Right. And that's what's so, I think, for so many people who do have loved ones who are serving, when they look at the images, even before General Soleimani was killed, there was that attack on the U.S. Embassy, where obviously Iraq gave, clearly allowed those protesters to get right up to the U.S. Embassy.
Yes, it very much so. That occurred in, you know, what's known as the Green Zone, and it's a heavily fortified area. And it does appear that the Iraqi security forces sort of looked the other way and allowed the Shia militia to gather very close to the U.S. Embassy.
And again, this was before General Soleimani was killed.
Correct. So it's hard to imagine that something, you know, of that nature, but of a different order of magnitude, isn't in the mail. But there are other possibilities too. You know, there are other presences. There's still 1,000 U.S. troops in Syria that could become a target for Shia militia there. And in fact, I mean, there Iran backs the Assad regime in Damascus, and was a very militarily capable individual regime. And it's entirely possible that they could target U.S. forces in northeast Syria. And then there's also like a small U.S. presence in Lebanon, where Iran has a very close relationship with Hezbollah, a proxy military force that operates in southern Lebanon, which is one of the most powerful political forces now in the country. So I would say in each of those three countries, there's a very vulnerable U.S. presence. Another possibility is that they go after the oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia. We saw in September when Iran hit some of the most important refineries in the world in Saudi Arabia, and had a major impact on oil prices globally. So that would be another option for them.
Right.
Go ahead.
So you are expecting that kind of, that there's going to be some kind of major response. And I think that's what, you know, I think so many people are waiting to see what it will be, and who will be targeted, and you know, you mentioned the Iraqi oil fields. I know that there are, you know, religious groups, certainly Jewish organizations around the world are concerned. There are concerns about for our troops. There are concerns about civilian targets around the world. A lot of concern as well. Your expertise and your organization assists refugees. What do you think this is going to do to the already critical situation in this region with refugees?
Sure. So if you just talk about the humanitarian situation in general across the Middle East right now, you have some of the worst humanitarian crises in Syria and Yemen. And these are both theaters, obviously, where the Iranian regime is quite active. Less so in Yemen, but very much so in Syria. And so any sort of heightened tension or conflict in these areas, you could easily see leading to a level of hostilities that could displace individuals or, at minimum, certainly disrupt relief operations. For example, if I were involved with an American NGO, like the international, any American humanitarian non-governmental organization that's doing humanitarian relief in one of these countries, you have to think quite carefully about whether or not you might become a target in the coming days. And I think many of them will be curtailing their activities because they're concerned about that.
Right. And have the groups, I mean, certainly we saw with ISIS crossing the line and targeting mm-hmm. individuals who were with humanitarian groups or journalists who were normally sort of hands off. Are the groups that are involved here, have they already crossed that line in other situations?
Well, we have seen some contact between some of these organizations and then humanitarian relief efforts in some parts of the Middle East. It hasn't been significant yet in the way it was with the Islamic State sort of shutting down or attempting to shut down Western relief efforts in many of these countries. I think the place, though, that's probably of greatest concern from a humanitarian perspective would be Yemen. And in Yemen, right, there has been a conflict going on now for about 4 or 5 years, which has created the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. You know, there are 14 million people who are deeply food insecure. And Iran is a supporter of one side of that conflict. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia support the other side in that internal conflict. And so those two parties, the various parties in Yemen, have been building towards some sort of political negotiation. We're beginning to see the first stages of talks brokered by the United Nations and elsewhere in recent months, and there was hope that the new year would bring some sort of breakthrough. I think that's going to be very, very difficult to have happen, at least in the first quarter, until sort of the full tension and magnitude of what's happening here really play out. And the danger there is if there's a heightening of tensions in Yemen through the different proxies, you could disrupt relief efforts, and there it could be catastrophic, right? Because if you have 14 million people who are in desperate need of food and those relief efforts are cut off, you're facing, famine conditions at a sort of biblical scale.
In terms of, where relief efforts, I mean, are relief efforts getting to people in Yemen, or only a fraction of them? Is there any relief that's getting through?
Yeah, there is. There's relief efforts going into both the areas that are controlled by the Saudi-backed coalition and into areas that are controlled by the sort of Houthi rebel groups. It's very difficult. I will say this, though. There are a series of economic informal blockades currently operating around Yemen, mostly run by the Saudi-led coalition, that make it difficult for assistance and even for commercial aid, commercial products to make their way into the country. It's challenging. And then inside of the Houthi-controlled area, the Houthi government has been quite like that militia has been very restrictive of humanitarian operations in those places. That said, humanitarians were able to, keep the country out of famine over the last year. And the question is whether or not that kind of access will continue.
And will humanitarian organizations pull back for a while just to wait and see?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think here's a good example. To the extent that in northeast Syria, where we've seen, the Turks invade the northeast of the country as the U.S. troops pulled back last October. That led to high levels of displacement, especially among Syrian Kurds. There were 200,000 people were displaced by that. It's a very limited international humanitarian presence there, and many of them have some sort of link back to the United States. And I think at this stage, many of those actors will have to be thinking about pulling out. because they're going to be concerned about like closing any kind of closures between Iraq and Syria, or any heightened tensions, or indeed being targeted potentially by, you know, Iranian proxies.
Well, listen, Hardin Lang, Vice President for Programs and Policy at Refugees International, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your insights. We certainly hope that those humanitarian efforts can, in fact, not only continue, but also thrive in those areas, and that certainly those people are not targeted, because that would be obviously devastating for so many. We appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.